always family-centered, always reaching out. Here is the host of our program, Erin Lay.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome back to Onward and Upward, the show where we're here to raise that proverbial bar and to bring character and awareness to families and society as a whole. And we have a fabulous guest today. She's now sought after by Homeland Security. Ms. Lee Kessler is a television actress, screenwriter, playwright, and stage director. Her career in Hollywood and New York spans 35 years and includes dozens of guest star roles in episodic TV, miniseries, and movies of the week. She had recurring roles in series, some of my favorites, Hill Street Blues and Matlock, and was submitted for Emmy nomination twice for her starring roles in the movie Collision Course and the ABC special Which Mother Is Mine. Lee co-starred with Peter O'Toole in the movie Creator and became the first actress in the world authorized to portray the legendary diarist Anaïs Nin when her play Anaïs Nin, The Paris Years was produced in New York and Los Angeles with a subsequent tour on the West Coast. She also directed the West Coast premiere of A.R. Gurney's Who Killed Richard Coy? I can't believe I'm doing this. Since the publication of her suspense novels White King and the Doctor and White King Rising, Lee has made numerous radio and TV appearances discussing the book's relevance, the outcome of the War on Terror, and has spoken often at book signings and private readings in New York and Los Angeles. In addition, during the development of her entertainment industry career, Lee became a successful entrepreneur, a pioneer in internet commerce, and today owns an international internet business which operates throughout the United States. She currently resides in Montana. And that's what happens when I don't have my reading glasses on. So I apologize for that introduction, Lee.
It's okay.
I'm so sorry. I need reading glasses. When I turn 42 all of a sudden, I'm trying to read. I'm like, oh, this is not working. This is not good. How are you?
Well, I'm doing just great. Thank you. It's going to be great being with you today.
Welcome to the show. So let's get to it. I mean, you went from an actress to an author, and how did you make the transition?
Well, it's a fairly easy transition since I had been in the entertainment industry. I had done writing, as you could tell from the bio, that I had written a play and had that produced and so on. So I had been writing and doing some screenwriting, but the ability to portray characters is part of what you'd need to write a novel anyway, as you're creating the characters for the storyline. So it was something that I had wanted to do. Now that I'm living not in L.A. anymore, but up in Montana, it's certainly easier to write than it is to act. So and I got into this project in a very unusual fashion, and it's certainly totally changed the direction of my life. So.
And how did this come about? You started with the White King and the Doctor, and then the sequel is White King Rising. Now, do you have to read White King and the Doctor prior to White King Rising?
No, each of them is a standalone book, so people could certainly pick up White King Rising and have a unique story all in and of itself. But it is a sequel to the first one, and a lot of the folks who've read both say it's definitely better to read the first one, they think, because it's a richer experience when you get to the second one, because you have a better understanding of the mind of a real-life enemy that we're facing, because the first book is through the point of view of the mastermind of Al-Qaeda, and that's a bit shocking for people, but enlightening to say the least. So, but they can read either direction, just depends. They're quite different. They just carry the story forward with the same characters, but the style is different, and certainly the content is very different.
And I know that when you and I spoke over the phone, you really had no idea that all of this was going to come to fruition. This is a fictional piece that you wrote, and the next thing you know, you had Homeland Security following you, asking you questions about did you have insiders and information about this, and can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes.
I mean, that's a little shocking.
Well, yeah, it has to do with how I told the story itself. I spotted after 9/11 and as we were coming up towards, especially the elections of 2004, that the United States was becoming progressively more divided to the point of, you know, like stimulus response hysteria here in the political arena, but that instead of being united, where I felt we should be, given the magnitude of what had happened to us, we were dividing. And I recognized that that would have to be what they call in military terms a fifth column, but it's just an inside force whose purpose is to break the solidarity of a unit that's about to be attacked. So if somebody wanted to bring down the United States or attack it successfully, they'd have to break us apart from within. So I started to look into that, and I decided to use my acting background where I'd had the opportunity to play real people. Along with years that I've had as a student of the mind and my marketing background, I simply decided to start with the real-life mastermind of Al-Qaeda. And I did the backstory research on that man, and in order to identify his driving motivation. Because if you get that right with a character, everything that that character does, whether you're playing it or whether you're writing about it, will seem real, and the audience will accept it, and it seems plausible. You can also explain what happened in the past with him. So anyway, I did it, and I began to project that, okay, if this is his motivation, then I should see these things start to play out in world events. And they started to. And that's where my life changed, because I realized I was on top of something that the media appeared to have missed, the military appeared to have missed, our government appeared to have missed, and how on earth was I going to communicate that? So I wrote the story, White King and the Doctor, to reveal what I thought was happening to us, but I was writing Aaron into the future. And as time has gone on since that first book was published, now the whole story seems true, because I was writing parallel to current events, and I would intersect with current events in my storyline. Now it's colliding so much that the intelligence community literally cannot separate the fact from the fiction. They think it's all true, and every day it plays out more true.
I mean, it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating, and as we know, united we stand, divided we fall.
Exactly.
It's right there. It's in black and white, and it's sung and everything else, and it's amazing that our government didn't see this coming, that you saw it coming, other people I'm sure saw it coming, but you were so articulate and writing and brilliant, and but divided we fall. I mean, the enemy knows this. The enemy knows us better than we know them, so we have to try to figure them out, as what you're saying.
Yes.
To get a better of their mastermind.
Yeah, exactly, because it isn't like our people miss the idea that there would be a divide-and-conquer strategy, but if you look at it conventionally, you tend to think of it militarily. You know, if you can divide two forces and sort of, you know, come down the middle, you can get them separated, and then you can surround them or take them down. It's the question of, if that's going to be the strategy, what types of scenarios would happen? And that's what I was looking at. Who are they, and how would they take us down? And that's where I think the creative imagination of the actress came in here. And I figured out some creative ways of how this particular guy, with his background, would attack us. And that's the part that they missed and overlooked, where when they look at it, they go, you know, this is very real and very possible. Very scary, but very possible.
And when you spoke to terrorists, like experts and stuff like that, what was their reaction? I mean, these are terrorist experts who are following these people, studying these people. They're the ones that are supposed to know what's going to happen next, and you're enlightening them.
Yeah.
What's their reaction to that?
Well, their reaction first was, we don't know how you could possibly have known this. In other words, it's almost as if I had a security clearance past any of them. And and so, but they, what was interesting, Aaron, is that I didn't get a pushback from them. I thought when I put the story out that I would expected some disagreement or some people, you know, hammering away at it, saying, oh, this is ridiculous what this author's putting forward. But they didn't. When they looked at it, too, they recognized that they had been looking at some of the same research data, because I had to find it in the way you or I would find it. I don't have any type of intelligence background or security clearance. I had to find it like the rest of us would. But when they looked at it, they didn't evaluate certain things with the degree of importance that I did. And they may not have been someone trained professionally to do a character analysis to actually be the person. That's a little bit different from doing behavioral analysis, which is statistical. I was actually probing one particular man who influences all of Al-Qaeda, and they influence all of the other terror groups who influence all of our lives. A little bit easier approach, but it does take a specific skill set. So they, not only the ones that have had an opportunity that I'm aware of, have endorsed it, they promote it, particularly Steve Luckey, who is a major counterterrorist guy and the National Security Council for the American Pilots Association, has told audiences, you need to read her books because what's in there is real. It's set in a fictitious story, but it is real. He said, we can't tell you the real truth of what's going on because it would terrify you so you couldn't move. It would, like, drive you down. But through Lee's stories, she gets you to look at the reality of it in a way that you can face and you can go forward with it. See, it was not my goal, Aaron, to scare people half to death. They're going to get scared because these are suspense novels and thrillers, and these are scary times. But I was looking for solutions. I was looking to figure out, okay, we know what they're doing, why they're doing it, and how they're doing it. Now we can beat it. And so people come away with some hope and some confidence after they face some awful stuff.
And while you were doing that, did you in your head think, okay, I hope Napolitano reads this? Seriously, like, you know, because you're seeing things that she's missing, you know, and that like I said, the terrorist task force, these people are missing these things, and you're seeing it, you know. When you were writing it, were you hoping that the president, the Homeland Security, that everybody will at least give it a thought?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It was, you know, it's my way of giving a gift to the public because it's the American people that are the real target here. You don't take America down without taking down the American people because of our spirit and who we are and what we try to be and how we try to help. So I was writing it basically for the public, but there's no question that I would hope and assume that some folks have had an opportunity to read it and would go, wow, that's interesting, extremely plausible, we'd better look there. I believe they will. But more importantly, I need the folks to understand it.
Absolutely, that's why they have to buy the books and read it. And when I was on the phone with you, I asked you, even for my 13-year-old, because believe it or not, even in middle school, they're being indoctrinated.
Yes.
He'll come home from school and he'll say, you know, my teacher said the end of the world is going to be because of global warming. And I said, honey, you're not going to get in trouble when the next time one of your teachers comes in with, like, a political view, because, you know, we talk politically open in the family.
Mm-hmm.
I said, tell them to leave it at the door. You know, you want to be educated, not indoctrinated with whatever their political views are. And why scare 12 and 13-year-olds?
Yes.
With this kind of nonsense, you know? But that's propaganda, yeah, and that's also what you and I talked about. All this propaganda, 24-hour, 7 days a week, all this, you know, bottom of the TV things going on. We're bombarded by so much that even if on both sides, Republicans, Democrats, mm-hmm. you know, the president, whoever, after a while they say the same thing over and over again. People are going to start to believe if it's a lie. People will start to believe it because it's being just said over and over and over again. And then just the propaganda that's thrown out there is just out of control. What do you have to say to that?
Well, that's on total agreement. That's one of the tactics, by the way, that the enemy is using. They understand that a lie told often enough becomes the truth. And they have found a way, by compromising, in my opinion, the American media, to get at us where we're bombarded, as you say, with a message day in and day out. It's relentless, but that message has been compromised. And so without knowing it, the media is putting forth a false picture. Now, it could be intentional on somebody's part, but a lot of it will be ignorance. And the first book reveals how that was done in some fascinating scenes with the major propaganda chief for Al-Qaeda as he compromises a foreign official and a major media mogul inside the United States, whose then reinterpretation of facts as he puts it out through his news gets copied by the other news media and gets copied by the others. And before you know it, the United States has embraced a viewpoint that was completely fictitious, implanted at a cocktail party in a foreign country. So,
unbelievable.
Yeah.
Plausible.
Yeah, so totally plausible, exactly. It's just
plausible, yeah. That's the best word, plausible. It's mind-boggling how these kinds of things can happen and how we as a society have gone this far into the ridiculous You know, this doesn't happen in Europe. You know, you don't see this 24-hour fear factor tactics kind of thing going on. You know, they'll play the news and whatnot, but it seems as though, and I know, you know, we're the target, America, and of course this is where everybody wants to come live. You know, well, if you don't like us, then why do you keep moving here?
Right.
You know, and even some of the people that live here, like Michael Moore and others who just, you know, they constantly bash America. Why don't they just leave? I don't understand. But having had all this propaganda and tons of indoctrination in Harvard and Yale and all these colleges, not just the Ivy League, but all over the place, they are having keynote speakers come in, and it's not like they're educating these kids anymore. It's, you know, they're literally indoctrinating. This is what should happen, and this is what should be, and you have to believe in this. You have to believe in that. We can't even say a prayer, Lee. A kid can't even say a prayer to themselves before eating lunch.
No, understood. Yeah, that's bizarre.
Then,
that's the subject of the second novel, by the way, is the undermining and erosion of all of our institutions within this country, because what you're describing there is it's a takeover, if you will, or a usurpation of the rights and authority of the parents, that the relationship between the parent and child, to my mind, is inviolate, and there's responsibilities on both sides there. But whenever the education system, and I grew up in a family of educators, great ones, frankly, and I myself was an educator at a college level before I went into the entertainment industry. But when the educator decides to override the authority of the parent or the viewpoint of the parent, that's where I start taking exception, and that is happening across the board. So it makes it harder and harder on the children. It catches them in between. At vulnerable times, too, in their lives where they're having to learn to think and reason. It's a little hard if they're dumbed down and drugged up to do that as well. And that's part of the attack line, in my viewpoint. So parents have got a job on their hands. And the school system, I don't believe, is delivering what it should and allowing the freedoms that the child needs to exercise his own judgment, too.
I agree. The education system is, you know, you would think with all the money going into it and all the taxes that you pay toward it and with the increase in school taxes, and they still take away more and more, even with musical stuff, and just to have a well-rounded child, a well-educated, well-rounded child to go into the real world is becoming, you know, harder and harder for the parents because they're going to school. There's zero tolerance. You know, the zero tolerance law or rule, whatever it is, where if there's a fight and somebody actually, like, defends themselves, they're in trouble too. And I can understand the zero tolerance to a certain degree, but I think it went too far.
Mm-hmm.
And where the victim becomes victimized twice. And, you know, like, that's a whole other story. But to get back to the White King Rising, you have, is it four heroes in this?
Yes. There's the James Michaelis. He's the CIA analyst. And then, of course, the Grandmaster Chess Champion, Andy Weir, who's the major hero along with Michaelis in the first book, Carry Through. Kelly Weir, the mom, carries through. And then the new hero, a guy from the hood. He's an African-American football-playing computer gamer. Who's used to play with Andy Weir, he enters the picture and actually resolves the situation. It's he who brings about a solution for this. And people are now writing in going, my Lord, I think that solution will work. And there are people who are quite knowledgeable in the area, but also committed, you know, citizens who are on top of these issues, watching the family aspects of it, young people themselves, because the second book is really written for Generation Y. That's the teens and 20-somethings. It's designed to help them understand what happened to them and how they can come out from underneath it and come forward. And they're now demanding, there's a game that gets created in the book that you read about in the book, and now they're demanding that the game be created, which I will do, just haven't done it yet. We're going to reserve that for a little bit later. But they're accepting the premise here is plausible and the solution is plausible, and we can solve this. You know, to my mind, there are three types of people: those that enhance, those that dominate, and those that nullify. So when you were talking earlier about people who do nothing but criticize or bash, they're nullifiers. It doesn't matter whether or not the criticism might be valid on a point. If all you're doing is nullifying and bashing, that doesn't serve well. What many of the parents are and children are experiencing is domination in the school system, which does not bring out a citizen that can function in life. You really have to enhance. And that means including allowing them choice and exercising their ideas, because we all learn through trial and error in life as well. Hopefully we gain some wisdom from the experience of those down the line. But in many cases, we have to go ahead and make our own choices and see what the consequences of those choices are in order to adjust and say, I can do that better.
Absolutely. That's the only way that we do learn, by making mistakes. You know, there's nobody that goes through life never making a mistake. A good friend of mine, Jim Bouchard, he always says he's a black belt, and his best-selling book is Think Like a Black Belt, and he does all these wonderful things. And he constantly says, get knocked down 7 times, you get up 8.
Exactly.
You know, and you learn every time you get up. You know, like that's how you go through life. Getting knocked down, but being able to have been brought up to where you can think for yourself when you get up again, you don't want to get knocked down 10, 20 times, and when you get back up again, you don't have the wherewithal to know how to move on from that mistake.
Oh, yes, one has to learn, yeah. Evaluate, learn from it, rethink it, then attack again whatever it is that we're attacking and get it better the next time, so you're moving from where you are to where you want to be. You know, even if it's a gradient approach to it, but that's the nature of living. And if that's not allowed or expected, let's say, even of the child, I don't believe they're going to have as good a shot at it. And that's what I think has happened, because Generation Y, when I talked to a lot of the young college students or people just getting out of college or even their parents, that generation is referred to as the trophy generation and sometimes the boomerang generation, meaning they try to leave and they're not prepared, so they come back home. So parents are finding themselves with 30-year-old kids still living at home. Because the child is out there, even working in his profession perhaps, but isn't able to make it yet. But the trophy generation, when I talk to them about what that means to them, it registers. And that's a lot of what I like to do, is get in front of the young people and explain to them how they as a generation are viewed and where that name trophy generation comes from and what it means, because it's not a compliment. And when they learn that, they go, oh, you know what? That is true about us, but we're not that. And I said, I know. That's why I'm talking to you. By the way, the trophy generation is a reference to the fact that this particular group of young people, and it's a huge generation that our future depends upon, is regarded as a group of people who cannot handle loss, cannot handle failure, cannot handle defeat or discouragement, and therefore they are given trophies just for showing up.
Which is never good. It's never good.
Because they don't learn about excellence, and defeat or loss, or competition, or any of the lessons that they would need to learn. But what's interesting, when I bring that up to the young people, I can see them look at it, and they go, you know, that's right. They're kind of looking in their life going, I was given a trophy. Everybody on the team got trophies. Everybody in the league got trophies, whether we won or lost. And that's because they're viewed as having very low self-esteem. Well, imagine being a generation, and that's how you're viewed, and you're not being challenged to face the hard choices or the hardships in life. But when they look at it further, and then I say, but that's not who you are. You're like we were. You have every capability in you, but you're going to have to become the hero generation, because the world situations today are going to require that, whether you wanted it or not, the baton is about to be passed to you. Are you ready? And if not, how are you going to get ready?
And what's their response?
Very positive.
Okay.
Because
I wasn't sure if they might get scared, nervous. What do I do, Lee? You know, I don't know what to do. So it's very positive.
Well, that's an okay place to start, because at that point, somebody's actually talking to them and not talking to a label. one of the biggest problems is that children are labeled, you know, labeled with all kinds of disorders, but they're also labeled on capabilities and all kinds of things. And if somebody, if they're used to just passing it off and passing responsibility, well, it's because of this and it's because of that, they're not assuming responsibility. But when you actually talk to them, they first, when they will look, and actually, and I can see them, you'll see them too, you'll see them actually look, and they find something, and when they go into agreement with that, even if their next question is, but how would I? At least they're engaged now, and they're aware that somebody is earnestly interested in them and talking to them, not just at them and not trying to push things at them, because they are going to have to create their own solutions. Lord knows I got some ideas in the stuff I write about. You certainly have ideas in the material that you present on your show. There are probably millions of parents who would have ideas. There's no shortage of places for them to go and look, but they also have to come to learn American history and history in general, I think, better. And understand context, and then things won't seem so scary.
Thank you. Yes, and the context. And as long as we keep American history as the truth, mm-hmm. without changing it, without changing the textbooks, and taking American, we spoke about this, American exceptionalism, and then just dumbing that down, and,
right.
you know, apologizing for it, and that kind of a thing. And that's where my concern as a parent, where when my kids, you know, get further into high school and whatnot, and the tests are going to be totally different, and the state tests, and the books are going to be rewritten and everything else, and it's going to be more apologetic for America, as opposed to the truth that we are exceptional.
Yes.
We are exceptional. I mean, it's the truth. It's not like, you know, we're just raising our hand saying, I want to be the one who's exceptional. We've proven it over and over again in history, and to rewrite history, just, you know, to placate an enemy. That infuriates me.
Well, and also pulls mankind backwards. You know, the standard is not perfection here. America's not perfect, and Americans are not perfect. I'm not perfect. But that's
Nobody's
not the
perfect.
Standard.
Right.
The standard is the continual elevation and raising and enhancement and movement forward. And that in that we are exceptional, and no one should ever apologize for that, no matter where they ended up in world history, that they ended up being the vanguard or a group of people that said, we can be better, we can do better, we can be freer, and we can afford freedom. I was lucky enough to be raised. My dad was an educator in New York State back when New York State was the number one state in the nation in education. Now it's not. And he was a phenomenal educator, but he never taught me. He taught me never to apologize for my talents and abilities or my exceptionalism, but rather to take those and use them to lift people up, not to bring myself down so that we're all trapped in mediocrity or worse. I remember very clearly how I was raised in terms of an underlying philosophy. Did I take what I have, and have I used it to bring people forward and up? Or did I
Yes.
sit on it and do nothing with it? Or worse yet, did I lower myself and reduce myself so that there again is that thing, you see, because we don't want to make somebody feel uncomfortable? That is a lie in and of itself. The very nature of success and prospering and forward movement is hinging on the ability to live in the fringes of fear or to move into a zone that is not comfortable and move through it to the point it becomes comfortable and then another and another. Any athlete listening to me would know the truth of what I just said. Anybody who's ever coached anything, music, sports, anything, knows the truth of what I just said. It's a progressive approach into the uncomfortable until it becomes comfortable and then on and out.
Yes, as opposed to going backwards or apologizing or coming across as insecure because you don't want to feel like you're bragging or, you know, but to be exceptional, and I'm not saying perfect because there's nobody on the planet that's perfect. There's no perfect family. There's no perfect wife, husband, kids. That's all malarkey. I mean, there's no such thing as perfection. You work toward perfection or whatever, but there's no such thing as perfection. But you try the very, very, very best that you can, and you get to a point that, by getting there, you could possibly help other people. So as opposed to just staying on, staying still and not bring that person up and just kind of like getting to their, you know, staying on par, you're not doing either one of you any kind of service. You know,
yeah.
Being proud and being, and like your father said, don't ever apologize for your talents. You know, you keep growing, you keep moving, and to bring somebody with you, that's the greatest gift that anybody can give.
Oh, I believe that. And in fact, the story of White King Rising is the story of who did that to us and how they did it to persuade us, or try to persuade us as a people, to reduce ourselves, apologize for ourselves, doubt ourselves, because there's an open door for an enemy when we're in doubt. So the story of White King Rising is who did that and how they do it. It's going to be shocking. It's shocking because it's inside America. It's not an external enemy. They're using that line, but it's being done to us from within. And it's not only will we go nowhere, but if we sink backwards, the rest of the world sink backwards. I call it the beginning of a new dark age. And we're right at that threshold. I'm very optimistic that we can win, but only if this generation recognizes that they've been lied to, they've been conned in many respects, they're being held down, and they step up and very quickly learn what they need to learn to at least get started, and then they go forward with some hope rather than... they're going to have to give up a few things, too. They're going to have to give up a few things that they are embracing now, but once they recognize who gave them those things, I think they'll drop them quickly.
You don't want to give up what it is that they have to give up?
Part of it, I can tell you that they are going to have to give up the drug scene. And I'm not just talking about the street drugs. I'm talking about pharmaceuticals in general. There's a whole party scene, but they're going to have to give up the drugs.
And thank you, yes.
Yeah, and I think that they got a sense on that. It doesn't take much. They get that pretty quickly in the story. And go into agreement with that, but also then I can kind of guide them to organizations that can help them see some true data of what's been undermining them, because it's been said that we're only one generation, any free society is only one generation away from slavery.
Right. And what president said that? It was centuries ago. But they said, we're never, we're only one generation away from
I believe it was one of our founding fathers, but if you look at it,
yes.
Yeah,
thank
and
you.
two generations back thank to you. Back, people are gone. And you see, that's why I'm writing what I'm writing right now and with certain passion and working as hard as I am, because the World War II generation is dying. They're nearly gone. And then it comes to baby boomers, which is my generation, and we're starting to die off. Then you have Generation X and Generation Y. And with the people gone who remember not only America, but what they had to fight for and what happened in Europe and then what happened subsequently in Russia and the Soviet Union and so on, with those people gone, if the youngest generations do not have an understanding of what America is, what it represents in all of mankind's history, and what happened throughout Europe and the rest of the world in the 20th century, they won't have any ability or understanding of what would be necessary for them to do to preserve freedom. Because you can have freedom, but you don't get to keep it forever unless you actively work to preserve it and enhance it.
I agree.
And I don't think they know that. I don't think they understand that at all, that they're going to have to make a contribution, and they better not be trying to make it through choices that actually enslave them or entrap them.
Like drugs and alcohol and anything that's going to distort the thinking.
Exactly.
You know, you need a clear head in order to move forward. Otherwise, you're stuck in a false reality, and that's not going to help themselves, their friends, their family, their kids, or whoever. So, and I also think that they should study the Constitution, which is huge.
Mm-hmm.
That is our ultimate law of the land. I'm not going to get into the health care bill, with turning the back on the Constitution, but that is the epitome of, that is the rule of this land. And if the kids aren't taught the Constitution, or even civility, just the basics of this country, and like you said, the history of this country, so they have something, they have a starting point, and then they can move from there. If they're going to start from, like, just today and try to move forward, forget it.
All right.
Forget it.
Yeah.
It's over. And that's why I advocate for, studying the Constitution and, like you said, the real history. And read the books that were written from generations and generations before us. And like you said, World War I, World War II, just see what went on with this country and what people have done to preserve freedom. Because like you said, it could be taken like that. Shiite law can come here in a heartbeat if we don't push back, which is exactly what we have to do to maintain our freedom.
Yes, granted.
So I also heard that you are going to have movies being made out of this.
Yes, the first book, we're very close to a major motion picture deal on the first book because it'll make a tremendous, suspense thriller because they're exciting stories with, page turners and twists and turns and great characters. So that's my intention. It always was from the moment I started the project. I knew that if I could tell great stories and have lots of people read the books, that's great. But if they could go up into major motion picture, then millions of people can see them, and they'll pick up the message in the midst of their entertainment and so on and have a good time with it. So we're close on that. There's a great team that's been working with me, and I'm expecting to be able to make announcements on that very soon, but can't yet.
Oh, they have to do it. They have to get the visual. Like, some people are very, very visual, and to get a visual on what it is that you're saying and what you're writing about, that will just be so intense that I just think it just brings it to the next realm, and I think it'll be phenomenal. It has to. It has to go into the motion pictures.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
Marianne Muldoon is on the line with us also. I told you about Marianne.
Yes.
She's nationally recognized award-winning psychotherapist and a Love and Logic parent facilitator, and she joins us every month, and she brings a fascinating, a different perspective on it, like from the psychological, and I'm sure she's going to love this. Marianne, you there?
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes, I can hear you too.
Okay. I've been a little bit on the blink here. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Marianne.
Congratulations on your success and all that you're doing. It's so fascinating.
Thank you.
You know what? I had a question about the trophy generation. I think you are so right. My question was who, and I don't know if you covered this, but who are the parents of the trophy kids? Is it the baby boomers?
Yes, and they're kind of loosening the generational thing now. It used to be it was on every 18 years, so they called the baby boomers those born from 46 to 64 and so on. So you'll have the tail end of the baby boomers, the later end of the baby boomers are Generation Y, and some of the early Generation Xers had Generation Y, depending upon when you pick up Y, but they're pretty typically regarded as those in their teens and 20s.
Do you know why or how this started? Because I work a lot with these types of children and young adults, and you're absolutely right, where they, maybe as baby boomers or who's underneath baby boomers? Generation whatever.
X, yeah.
We thought we were doing the right thing by protecting and coddling these children, and then they grew up, and they're now unable to leave the house.
Exactly.
So,
well, I think you're on top of it. I don't.
Done a lot of research.
Well, it's like that old saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I don't necessarily assume that. For each individual parent, it came out of malintention. It wouldn't have, I don't think. We all want to help, but we have
to be supportive and help, but it kind of backfired, huh?
Exactly. Help has to be true help and not a betrayal. And so I think probably people didn't stop to say, but what would help actually look like? I remember my dad, and see, I was born late in life to them, so he was World War II generation. But he was already middle-aged during that time. And I remember him telling me, though, when I was growing up, he said, Lee, any time you do for someone something that they could or should do for themselves, you degrade them and you demean them. And that was coming up in a discussion we were having on race issues and so on back in the 60s, but also just in life in general. And so out of good intention, sometimes we can overhelp people. I know I've been guilty of that in my business activities where sometimes I will overhelp. And instead of creating someone who was more independent, I was inadvertently creating someone who was dependent. Not just physically dependent, but psychologically dependent, meaning they needed my thoughts, my ideas, rather than knowing and trusting their own. Mm-hmm. And so I think that started to come into it, that we wanted to help them, but in so doing, we trap them. And
I was also, maybe it was about the competition between I'm saying parents, but it could be anybody, teachers, adults, the system, that, well, my child deserves an A also, or my child should be in the top class also. Like, you know, my thoughts is maybe it started as a competition in a way, and, you know, everyone deserves a trophy, and then everyone ends up getting a trophy, but we weren't really looking at the big picture,
right,
which is they can't deal with any loss, and they can't really fend for themselves. They can't handle any kind of setback, because I see that all the time, so I think it's such a great point.
Yeah, well, I agree. You know, we have to step, if you can step up and back a little bit and look at a broader picture, you can see things a little better. You know, it's the nature of command in the military, but also if you go hiking or mountain climbing, the higher up the hill or mountain you go, the more you can see. And the nature of even scouting, that if you're high enough up or you're far thinking enough, forward thinking enough, you could see the outcomes of the choices you make. That's the value of the game of chess, by the way, and I use the chess motif in my first book with the Grandmaster Chess Champion. It's the ability to project out if these choices when made lead to others when somebody responds, and it's that flexibility of the mind. I don't think we did that very much. And if anything, we just sort of said, well, I'm going to try to make it comfortable for right now without realizing that each right now ultimately leads to a completed picture. And is that picture one that is a life that's independent, functioning, brilliant, carrying us forward? Because I, on my watch, I sure don't want this to be the last time we had great generations that were freedom-oriented and exceptional and progress-oriented and solving the problems, whether it be of starvation or famine or environment or anything else. Only bright people will solve the problems of the physical universe.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need bright, competent people, young people who challenge, too. I never saw anything that involved progress happen from somebody who was a status quo individual.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah,
it had
and Marianne, I'm sorry.
No, I'm done.
Can I ask both Lee, you and Marianne, now with the schools for years, and I have educators in my family also, and they went from, you know, if you got something wrong, you used the red pen. That's the way, you know, I grew up. I'm 45. And it was marked wrong. It was, with the red pen. And then it got to the point where the schools weren't allowed to use the red pen anymore. You had to mark all the ones they got right as opposed to what they got wrong. And it just became like that mentality. I mean, positive reinforcement is great, but I think if it's all positive reinforcement and the kids aren't seeing that, you know, I made a mistake, and then they're not held accountable for those mistakes, I don't think that you're raising forward-thinking children.
Right.
Yeah.
If it's all positive, then it's just neutral. Right?
Right, but it also isn't life. Unfortunately, every kid's going to get out of school at some point.
Yeah.
And is going to have to go out there where life itself in the various real scenarios and work and family and relationships and everything have those moments where you're winning and those moments where you're not. And you better know where you're not, because that's where you want to focus your correction. If you're not looking at the exact point, the correction is general and probably weak and isn't going to work. You know, how we fix things is to fix the exact wrong thing. Heaven help the doctor who was going to go in on a surgery, and he cuts into the wrong part of the body just because it was sort of in the area.
Right.
That's really, what you're saying is so fascinating because, you know, like you just said, in real life, it's so different. And I think now, you know, in America, well, and throughout the world, with our economy, these trophy kids are in shock because they can't even get jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like it's really totally backfired. It's not even like the real world today. You graduate college, you can't even get a job. So it's really like getting smacked in the face, coming from that trophy mentality to not being able to even work.
Oh, yeah. Talk about something that would hit at your self-esteem and cause you to maybe doubt yourself.
Yeah.
Unless you understood the context of business, economics, commerce. And by the way, this thing that's happening to us economically, in my opinion, is not just the normal recession cycles and so on, that the primary line of attack of our enemy is economic. That point is made pretty clearly in my book, certainly will be in the third one, that the diversion of the military and this and that and the other thing does keep us with our attention diverted, and the media plays into that. But the primary attack line is an economic one to drive us down. And when you talk about a generation that can't even find jobs, and then you find the parents ahead of them that are struggling with that, and situations that are relentless and crippling debt and so on, the strangling of Americans' financial confidence and initiative. It's not just our national confidence and the world's confidence in us. That is a big part of it. But all you have to do is weaken the American's confidence in his ability to figure it out and solve it and find some way to win.
Right.
You know, I had to do that. My husband passed away very suddenly and unexpectedly 2 years ago, and the first book was out. I had just finished the first draft of the second, and that was an upheaval in my life. And I know, Aaron, the things that you faced in yours, but we figure out a way to win when adversity comes, and that's the nature of the forward movement of man. And the importance of us is our ability to think and reason through, even if it's tough. Well, fine, it's tough. But we get better and stronger when we figure it out. So I think all of us have had to be somewhat flexible and creative in these last few years. And if we have a generation coming behind us that can't do that, we're going down, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I call it the entitlement generation. They feel they're entitled to everything. My doctor said that all the doctors graduating from college, going into as interns and residents, just don't know anything because they feel they're entitled to everything. Marianne, what do you have to say about that also as a psychotherapist?
I completely agree, but again, I feel that when they get their internships, they can't even hold on to internships because of what's going on, you know, in the economy. I work with people in their mid-20s who can't hold down free internships, which that is even worse than when we were young. You know,
wow.
Like Lee is saying, this is kind of globally a different picture than we've seen. So, yes, they are entitled until, again, they hit the real world. And then I think it's worse than we've dealt with or our parents have even dealt with.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a downward spiral you're seeing happen there. And it's the pressure's greater because the speed on the downward end is on the rotation is faster, and it does have to be reversed. It can be. I mean, I'm very optimistic. I certainly got some solutions laid out there, and it will be reversed. But not if people are not aware and not awake and not willing to confront it. And by confront, I don't mean, you know, smacking somebody in the face, but face without avoiding, you know, just being willing to look at something. I've always been a believer that what you can face won't take you down, but what you can't face will.
You know, when you say awake, what just hit me was what you were talking about drugs. You know, when you're taking ongoing medication for years and years, many times you're not really awake.
For sure.
And so you're absolutely right with the drug piece. I think it has to change.
Yes, I work with them in human rights to help young people with that and understand the devastation on the body and the mind of long-term drug usage. So it does have to change, and it can. They can change that in a second. That's just a decision of the young adult to say, you know what, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm just not doing it, and I'm going to face what I have to and get that being uncomfortable doesn't mean you're a failure. It simply means you're in a learning process. And as long as you decide that you're in a learning process rather than a failure process. And that's the support of being able to associate, whether it's through the books they read or the people they hang out with winners and champions. Because if young people associate with someone who's a winner, they'll pick up a winning mentality.
Yes.
And if they're all hanging out with everybody who's in agreement, that there's something fundamentally wrong with them and they have to be, you know, passed along and coddled and taken care of.
Misery.
Yeah. Then that's
sure.
What they're going to become.
I'll tell you who you are kind of thing.
Yeah. That's who they're going to become. Yeah.
You know, I have a question also for both of you. It seems as though everybody I talk to is on some sort of anti-anxiety, antidepressants, and everything else because we're living in a world of such drama, you know, of such real, like, oh, my God, and not just from the terrorists, but everything is terrifying, like you said, Lee, with the economy, where they want to affect the economy and we're distracted with the military and everything else. But everything seems so incredibly intense that everybody's taking some sort of a medication for the anti-anxiety or the antidepressant, and then that really will keep you numb as opposed to moving on.
Yeah, I agree. Right? I'm you're right on the hub of both my stories, of the use of terror and why it's used and how Lenin taught that it would be used and what it's supposed to produce, the effect it produces, and then the solution is provided by an enemy here. And because that would be an example, not even setting aside the horrific side effects of these medications and the dangers of the drugs, that would be an example of running from something and hiding from it rather than facing it. If we've got a difficult scene to face, we'd better be sober when we do it. You know, I certainly don't want a drugged up pilot flying an airplane if all of a sudden he goes into heavy turbulence, you know. I want people exactly in the moment. And able to think their way through very, very, very quickly, but not hiding from. If something's scary, it's scary. But the part of growth as a human being is moving through that on your own power and not running from it or alleviating it through the dependence on a drug. That, to me, is another type of dependency over and above what might be an addictive tendency.
And Marianne, what do you think about that also? I mean, I see so many people on, you know, on antidepressants.
I have 15 thoughts as you're speaking, but I really do agree with you. I'm sorry, my phone is beeping through, so I'm a little bit preoccupied.
We don't hear the beeps, don't worry.
You hear the beeps, yeah, I just won't pick up.
No, we don't hear the beeps.
You don't hear the beeps, okay,
nope.
Great. You know, is it okay if I get off the subject for 1 second? I just have one more question.
Sure.
You know, when we talk about America and us, you know, being special and being separate, I want your opinion, Lee. Don't you feel like eventually we have to become one as mankind? Like, we are so separated from each other as individuals, as countries, in society. You know, don't you feel, or this is how I feel, that the future relies on us becoming one and leaning on each other? And why should we, you know, what is it that we are so separated that we have to be better than?
Well, that is a wonderful question. My personal view in life is that there are different compartments in life as it exists. One, we're ourselves, we are ourselves, but we also have a family, a group, you know, which would be our immediate family. And then there are groups that we're part of. For example, we're three women on this phone today. We're part of a group called women. We're part of racial groups. We select church groups, or we select business groups and so on. And we're part of national groups. We're all Americans, and we're part of groups. And then there's another, the larger group is mankind. Then there's all living things, and then there's all spiritual things. So there are a number of groups. And I don't personally believe that we have to eliminate or evaporate the borders on all of those and have the individual be the whole, but rather that we need to rationally and sanely operate with all of those groups, that our family has to be a sane and rational functioning group inside our other groups that we're part of, and that we can be Americans and still be part of mankind, and that we do need to make choices that are good for mankind, that the choices we make need to be those choices which provide the greatest good for the greatest number of all of those groups. And when you get one group, let's say it's a nation, that decides that its viewpoint needs to be the viewpoint of the entire rest of the world, that to me would be an aberration, if you will, or an abnormality. But if we as Americans, we can stand strong and say, look, we know who we are, we know what our purpose is, we know what our nation represents, but we are also part of mankind, so we're going to respect all other religions, all other races, all of mankind, see that mankind prospers around the planet. Now, there's all kinds of questions on how you accomplish that, but that's that progressive state of moving towards a higher ideal. That's where I like to live and work, is to help us move to the point we can do that without war and criminality and insanity and all the stuff that's going on now. That we can let mankind live and yet live with his separate groups, so there can be the different religions, but they don't have to be warring as they have been for thousands of years. The races can, obviously we're not going to change the color, and that's in the nature of the body, but the different races can understand, yeah, there are differences, So what? We're part of one larger thing called mankind.
That's very good. That was fantastic.
Thank you.
That was fantastic.
Well, I completely agree. I don't even have a comment. That was excellent. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And we only have a few minutes left for the show. Lee, I want you to let everybody know how they can get in touch with you.
Well, I'm on Facebook, of course, so they can find me there. And if they're going for the books, obviously they can get those through Amazon. But if they want to get in touch with me, I would just do my fan page at Lee Kessler Storyteller. But I'm easy to find. I'm easy to Google search. They'll find me.
I'm sure. You've done so much.
Yeah.
You've done so much. And also WhiteKingRising.com.
Yes, that's a wonderful place to go to pick up insights about the book, or reader comments, radio and TV interviews. There's all kinds of stuff on that site. It's a fun one.
The first two chapters.
Oh, yes, they can read that. And the WhiteKingAndTheDoctor.com as well was set up so they can get into what was going on with that book and read the storyline, but also the first two chapters or three.
That's great. I can't thank you enough for being on the show. And Marianne, you also, as always.
Thank you so much, Aaron.
And Lee, it was a pleasure. It was an honor.
Well, thank you.
I hope to speak with you again.
I would love that. And Marianne, nice chatting with you, too.
You too. This is wonderful.
I want to thank Bonnie Lears for connecting us. She's a producer.
Yes.
And she's been with you at conferences, and she spoke so highly of you.
Yes.
So. Okay. Bonnie's saying that you're on her on Facebook?
Yep, on my
profile. On her profile page. There's a picture of you with her.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I remember signing her book very recently. Yes.
Holding a book. It's terrific. For Bonnie Lears, L-I-E-R-S-E. Bonnie Lears on Facebook. So that's great. That's great. All good stuff. All good stuff because it's all optimistic stuff.
Yes.
It's not, oh, it's downhill and that's it. It's all, this is fascinating. Talking about dark stuff, but really shining the light on it and moving forward with optimism.
Yeah. That's the goal.
Onward and upwardly.
Yes. Perfect title, exactly.
But I want to thank you again. Thank you for joining us, and I hope to speak with you soon. And at the end of every show, I always read my hope quote, because hope, to me, is like the greatest character trait someone can have. Without it, everything else sort of, you could be kind and compassionate and everything else, but if you feel hopeless yourself, how can you really project that? So my thinking of you, hope quote, goes like this. Of all the forces that make for a better world, none is so powerful as hope. With hope, one can think, one can work, one can dream. If you have hope, you have everything. And I hope everybody has a great day. Thank you so much, and I look forward to seeing you again. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.